The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
America, bonjour, hi, Canada, Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway on this Wednesday, May the 11th in the year of our Lord 2022. So glad you are here. I noticed the big difference when I spent Monday morning, which was a school morning with my grandkids and daughter, that the big difference between 1966 when I was 10 and 2022 when she is 10, my oldest, is that there's no television on in the house with the Today Show on. And I'm just wondering, I wonder how many people actually still have the TV on when you get up. That's what I woke up to every day forever, was the Today Show. Mom and Dad were up and getting ready for the day, and they were watching the Today Show. Nobody does that anymore, I don't think. Maybe there are some people out there who get up early and watch the Today Show. I don't know. I haven't looked at their ratings, but it just struck me that this generation of young parents are not really taking their cues from the news being offered on television. They come to me. You should download the Salem News channel and just watch me as well as listen to me, put me on. Let's go to the news. Vladimir Putin gearing up for a prolonged war and will not stop at the Donbass, according to the Telegraph. The Financial Times hits the same note. Vladimir Putin preparing for a prolonged conflict in Ukraine. Both of these are based upon statements by the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, in the United States. The DNI is Avril Haines. He said, we have assessed that Putin's just going to consolidate his gains in the Donbass and then push on. This has prompted as well the Prime Minister of Poland to issue a statement, his name is Morawiecki, that Vladimir Putin is, quote, more dangerous than Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin because of his ideology and because of the weapons that he possesses. In some respects, that is true. It is hard to believe, but of course, there's a lot that happens that we don't believe in this decade, that Putin would use his nuclear arsenal, because as surely as day follows night, that's the end of his regime. He could take down a lot of the world with him, but that's the end of his regime. So that's kind of the grim way that we begin this morning. The DNI of America saying Putin isn't going anywhere except pouring more and more troops in. The rumor of martial law has swept through Russia and in Europe. At the same time, though, in our crazy world in which we live, Eurovision has kicked off with the first semifinal last night. Norway pretty much astonished the... If you saw Eurovision Song Contest with Will Ferrell in 2020, COVID did a lot of bad things. That movie was one of them. So we've got, on the one hand, the Polish Prime Minister worrying about the Russian president using nuclear weapons, and we have Eurovision. That's the world of 2022. Gun homicides in 2020 surged to the highest level in 26 years. The firearm homicide rate in the United States rose 35% in 2020. That is quite significant, given that it happened during COVID. I think it suggests, I'm extrapolating from the wonderful book, A Good Month for Murder, which came out by Del Wilber, a couple of years back, where he investigated every murder committed. He accompanied police on every murder investigation committed in Prince George's County outside of Washington, D.C. and Maryland in the month of February, I think it was 2018. And people were killing for drugs back then. There's been 4 or 5 years since that book came out, A Good Month for Murder. And most of the homicides were narcotics-related people, including a bunch of addicts who needed $20 for their next hit. They just didn't think beyond that. And I think a lot of this gun violence is related to the fentanyl trade, which brings me back to the question of whether or not Mike Waltz tweeted out last night, would it be really such a bad thing if Trump had sent the missiles to hit the cartel labs? And I kind of agree with that. Given that they're killing 100,000 Americans a year, maybe we ought to look at that. President Biden gave a press conference yesterday. According to the Journal, he was looking to sharpen the contrast with the GOP as challenges grow. In fact, I'm going to play a lot of that. He said inflation is top priority for him. We'll play a lot of his press conference later in the hour. And, you know, he's not helping himself. And Democrats cringe through the whole thing. It's just a litany of fiascos and errors and purposelessness and aimlessness. And that is not confidence inspiring when you're the producer. The inflation number comes out this morning, I think around 8:30. I'll probably be able to give it to you. Federal judge dashes Democrats' hope for New York district map. So redistricting has been caught up in litigation. They went, you can win if you're a bear, you can win if you're a bull, you cannot win if you're a pig. And that's the oldest rule on Wall Street, and it applies to redistricting. They pigged out in New York, and they even upset their Democrat judges, their own state highest court said, nah, we're not going for this. And a federal judge in Albany said, push back the date and get an expert to redraw the maps. So New York is going to get some interesting maps. We'll wait and see. Emboldened by wins, GOP goes all in on the culture war. Now, you know, that's a headline. And Annie Linsky's a fine reporter. It begins this way. Republicans believe they found an edge in the culture war. Now, on the campaign trail, she writes, they're railing against critical race theory and gender identity discussions in schools. First of all, they're not railing. Second of all, those aren't the culture war. That's the education war. The culture war is freedom of religion and abortion. I believe that it's always been that way. But the education war is new. That's not the culture war. They do not want, parents do not want the schools dumbed down and the schools politicized and the schools using inappropriate discussions with kids K through three about intimacy and human sexuality. They just don't. They do not want that. Zero, full stop, period. And all the crazy teachers on TikTok, and they represent a tiny, minuscule number of people who are out there saying that they're out there teaching sexuality and the parents don't know it. Well, the school board elections in Texas over the weekend, which wiped out existing school boards. I've been predicting this. School boards everywhere. If you're an incumbent, you're doomed. And you might even be the best incumbent in the world. Schools are simply going to be brought to heel by the parents who elect primarily school district leaders. And you're going to see a lot of superintendents lose their job. You are. You're going to see a lot of superintendents pushed aside because parents have had it. They want their kids to be ready to learn, to read, to learn. So the first 3 years are spent K through three, learning to read so that four through on, you read to learn. And they want their kids to know algebra and trigonometry and analysis and calculus. And they want their kids to know American history by the dates, not by the crazy ideology of the left. They're sick of it. They've had it. And that's a Democratic problem. It's not a problem for the Republicans. Nobody wants to change the schools into teaching any kind of theology or anything. They just want to go back to good old fashioned teachers teaching good old fashioned lessons with good old fashioned discipline and maybe even a few dress codes thrown in. Roe v. Wade reversal would be very damaging to the economy, says Janet Yellen. I believe I've got that clip somewhere. Let me see where I can. Yes, yes. It's cut number 26, please. This is absurd.
Certainly don't mean to say what I think the effects are in a manner that's harsh. What we're talking about is whether or not women will have the ability to regulate their reproductive situation in ways that will enable them to plan lives that are fulfilling and satisfying for them. And one aspect of a satisfying life is being able to feel that you have the financial resources to raise a child, that the children you bring into the world are wanted, and that you have the ability to take care of them. In many cases, abortions are of teenage women, particularly low income and often Black, who aren't in a position to be able to care for children, have unexpected pregnancies, and it deprives them of the ability often to continue their education to later participate in the workforce. So there is a spillover into labor force participation, it means that children will grow up in poverty and do worse themselves.
Thank
and
you. Let me just
Secretary Yellen, the children will grow up is the operative phrase there. And that's absurd. What she said was absurd. I mean, there are a lot of arguments for and against abortion, and the result will be a legislative battle. And she just weighed in. But I think she devalued the office of the Secretary of the Treasury by opining on something about which she has no expertise whatsoever. It was just talking point time. Meanwhile, in the New York Times, Jeff Maurer, former senior writer for Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and a former speechwriter at the EPA, has a New York Times piece, "Democrats have an image problem. Please don't make it work. Worse, Democrats have an image problem. We're seen as the party of urban elites, pampered, overeducated dweebs, soft-handed dandies who ride scooters without embarrassment and name our pets after jazz musicians. Effete, self-important twerps slipping kombucha in an open-floor office plan of some startup. Crisp, the app that provides a bespoke celery experience. Maybe. And I can talk like this because I'm one of these dorks." Yes, 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 Jeff. You have spoken for the Democrats, and the country is sick of them. I'll be right back, America. Joe Biden gave a press conference, but so did Elon Musk. Guess which one was interesting and which one was a mess? Stay tuned. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Fox News. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm doing well. Thank you.
So I managed to walk the audience through the president's fiasco of a presser yesterday. Did you watch it live?
Yes. I watched it live, and I listened to your summation.
What did you make of this? Can we put up with this for 2.5 more years?
Well, here's one thing that I was thinking about as I listened to you, and your presentation had a it's just too easy feel to it.
Yes.
One thing I would suggest is the White House puts, like any other White House, puts out fact information sheets for whatever policy or initiative the president is announcing. And with the Biden White House, you get to see what he's going to announce, but without all the fun things that the president says, like being able to taste your frustration with inflation. And, you know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting yesterday about this, and it wasn't really featured as much, but that they're absolutely not backing down an inch from their environmental green energy agenda. As a matter of fact, they've decided that pursuing the green energy agenda is the way to bring down inflation. So instead of using the president's kind of garbled remarks, I'm going to read you just something from the White House press release. They want to achieve real energy independence. You know, all those Republicans who said the U.S. reached energy independence under Trump. No, no, no. We're going to reach real energy independence under President Biden, advancing the strongest ever fuel economy standards for cars and trucks. So that's the way they're fighting. One of the ways they're fighting inflation is to have higher fuel economy standards for cars and trucks, to enable drivers to go farther on every gallon while increasing options for families to make the switch to electric cars via historic investment. So they're talking about spending more on subsidies for electric vehicles, historic investment in charging infrastructure, and collaboration with auto workers and automakers to set America on a course to ensure that one of every two cars sold in 2030, which is 8 years from now, burns no fossil fuels.
So, you see, Byron, what that is, in my view, is that is a call to arms to the remaining elements of the Democratic base that have not slunk out the door. They need the abortion rights absolutist advocates to be in their rowing, and they need the green people to be in their rowing. So the only way they can see to get past November is to mobilize every bit of their base and ask them not to look at the man behind the curtain who's got 8.5%, 9% inflation written on him.
So if the big issue is inflation, we'll just use inflation to present that pre-existing green agenda, which I just thought that was one of the more interesting.
Do you think that's effective?
Aspect.
I think you're right. You're absolutely right. I did not know that because I did not get the handout. Do you think that works?
Oh, with voters? No.
Yeah. No.
Absolutely not. No. I mean, they're driving their car and they're paying $100 to fuel up, you know, a truck. It's absolutely not going to work.
Yesterday, my friends at the Washington Post had a story on how Republicans are banking on the culture wars, and they said it's education and abortion. Well, in fact, I don't consider education a culture war issue. I consider that an education issue. But they also noted that maybe the abortion decision isn't having quite the effect that Democrats expected. And I just want to say to them, a supermajority of Americans support reasonable restrictions on abortions. It's not going to have that effect, Byron. And
you know, this has never been an issue I've specialized in, but it just seems like there's a big, broad middle on abortion
yes.
in the United States. And the clearly, all the polls I've seen shown a majority do not want Roe overturned, but they support fairly restrictive limits on abortion. And so what you have, I would urge you to read the Democrats' Women's Health Protection Act, which is the codification of Roe that Charles Schumer wants the Senate to vote on, I think maybe today.
I think it is today. Yeah.
They want to make abortion legal at all stages of pregnancy, and especially, they specifically do this, forbid the states from passing any limits on abortion. So they've completely moved themselves out of this great middle on abortion. And I think that goes back to what you were saying about their pro-choice lobby, their environmental lobby. They got to get everybody in the boat rowing because it looks so bad for November.
There will be an anti-gun push as well because they need to get the gun control people. And so there are not enough activists to make a majority anywhere outside of New York City. Byron, the
Correct.
Politico's lead piece today is that the court meets for the first time tomorrow since the leak. I think it is, given what we've seen, number one, it's a political disaster for Democrats that the crazy people are in front of Justice Alito's house. And number two, I think they need to issue the judgment opinions to follow as Tom Cotton recommended 10 days ago. What do you think?
You think they need to just do it right now?
They need to issue the judgment opinions to follow, which they did in the Nazi saboteur case in the 40s, because it's important to at least remove any incentive for a fanatic to hurt a justice.
So you think that the issue is for the safety of the justices that they should do this? I mean, I'm not sure what I'm getting at. I don't know why. I don't see a great reason for going outside the Supreme Court's standard procedure. In this, obviously, there's been this huge, unprecedented leak. It has created this firestorm, and I do think, by the way, the demonstrations at the justices' house kind of suggest what the leak was about, which was to get this out there and create a firestorm while there was still time to change the result. And so now you see these groups trying to pressure the justices. I think it's going to completely backfire on them. I don't think anybody's going to be persuaded by it. But I have thought throughout that they should probably stick to their procedure on this.
I want to argue that with you because if they've got five firm votes and they know that they're going to overrule Roe and Casey, and they've just got to let the dissents put their dissent together, and maybe the chief does a concurrence like he did in Citizens United while joining the majority. There are lots of things that could happen. But if there are five votes to say we're going to overturn Roe and Casey, the present danger to justices of fanatics is real. And I drove past Sunday last the softball baseball field where the Bernie Sanders supporter stalked, prepared, and tried to kill half the Congress. And we have a number of fanatics in this country. And if you incentivize them to do something like harm a justice, I'm not comfortable with that. Remove the incentive. They can't change a decision once.
How does releasing the vote remove the incentive?
Because it's not a judgment until it issues from the court as a judgment. And so if a judge were to drive his or her car off of a cliff tomorrow by accident, the majority vanishes. They haven't issued a judgment, so it can change into the last day.
But that doesn't, I mean, if the vote total becomes known and it is to overturn Roe and Casey, I don't think that changes. I mean, your knowledge of the procedures of the Supreme Court exceeds that of most Americans. I think that if
I had lunch yesterday with
Republicans voted to take away a woman's right to choose.
Yeah, I had lunch yesterday with a Supreme Court clerk, which I am not a former Supreme Court clerk, and the shock to the court is real, but the incentive, you can change a decision by removing a justice, Byron. And that's the bottom line. That's what the incentive is. If you're a nut, if you're so bold as to release a leak, that puts you already in the fanatic camp, but you didn't use violence. You're just attempting to incite violence against someone. And with the Bernie Sanders thing in the back of my head, Bernie Sanders didn't want that guy to go in and shoot Steve Scalise and try and kill 30 congressmen, but it happened. And we're kind of crazy to ignore the James Earl Rays and the Saran Sarans that are out there.
Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that you're advocating an action to assure the safety of the decision as opposed to the safety of the justices.
No, I believe that the decision itself will remove the incentive to harm a justice. Therefore, I am trying to help the justices and their
families. In other words, you don't think revenge would be the justice's like a motive?
No, it doesn't do anything. The judgment is in. It's over. The res judicata applies. And they have to start all over again if they want to try and reverse that decision with another abortion case, which I don't think the court would ever do.
Well, the fight, I mean, obviously, if they do what the draft opinion said, the fight will shift to a lot of states because obviously nothing's going to happen on this national codification front. So it'll shift
Correct.
To states.
And that's the sooner it shifts, the better, in my view. Byron York, we'll be looking for you on Fox and reading you on Twitter at Byron York. And, of course, in the pages of the D.C. Examiner. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you, Byron. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172.
Senator Rick Scott, Wisconsin, a member of the Senate Republican leadership, laid it all out.
Back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, and I am joined by Mike Gallagher, who has a new senator from Wisconsin. The president announced that yesterday, Senator Rick Scott from Wisconsin. Were you aware of that, Congressman Gallagher?
I was not. Usually we have the problem of the so-called snowbirds, which is wealthy Wisconsinites avoiding taxes and moving to Florida for 6 months in a day. So it's good to get a wealthy Floridian to move back to Wisconsin and reverse the snowbird migration.
I think you should send your Packers gear over to the senator's office today and welcome him to Wisconsin, since Joe Biden has placed him squarely in the dairy state.
I will gladly. I have extra gear. You're also welcome to borrow my gear at any time. You looked very good when you wore it after you lost our bet last season.
I just stepped on a rake.
Okay.
All right. Let's get to the series. I just stepped on a rake. I can't believe that. I'm a broadcast professional. I stepped on a rake. Vladimir Putin prepared for prolonged conflict in Ukraine, warns U.S. This is the director of National Intelligence, Haines, in a statement yesterday. How do you read that? What's that mean to you, Congressman Gallagher, on the Armed Services Committee and the Intel Committee in the House?
Well, I think since Vladimir Putin abandoned his original plan, which was sort of a blitzkrieg, fait accompli, we'll take Kyiv, we'll force the government in Ukraine to collapse, Zelensky will fold like a cheap suit. Obviously, that plan was built on a series of false assumptions. He has now really focused his attention on the south of the country and continues to shell in devastating fashion Mariupol and Odessa. And I think now he is dead set on maintaining effective control of the southern part of the country so as to establish a land bridge from Crimea to Russia and have total dominance of the Black Sea. Now, perhaps you might think that's not as bad as him taking over all of the country, and it isn't, but it's still absolutely devastating to the country and the people of Ukraine. And I don't see Putin turning and retreating back to Russia anytime soon. So we have to remain steadfast in our support of Zelensky, which is why I think it was a good move to support this enhanced assistance bill to Ukraine that we passed last night. I know the overall number, the sticker shock, scared a lot of people. But keep in mind, less than $10 billion of that is going directly to the Ukrainians. I would submit they have proven that they can use those weapons we're giving them very well. And anytime you have our partners on the ground at a very low cost destroying Russian warships, I think that's a good investment geopolitically. That's an investment in our own security over the long term. And the rest of that money, the overwhelming majority of the rest, goes to us, to our defense industrial base, to help replenish our stockpiles. And one of the biggest things that concerns me right now, Hugh, is that we are going Winchester on a lot of key missile systems that we're not only going to need in Ukraine, we're going to need for the Taiwan fight. We went through
Congressman, going Winchester, would you explain that for the Steelers fans?
Oh, basically expending all your rounds, firing everything in your arsenal.
Highly technical term. Highly technical term. Yeah. So that's actually what Trump inherited when he came in. The shelf was bare. Jim Mattis said that. There just wasn't anything to spend or shoot. So how quickly can the United States replenish its stocks?
Well, here's the problem. On a lot of these missile systems, Hugh, they have so-called long lead items. Basically, 30% of the components of a missile system require a lot of time to get compiled and then constructed into a missile. So we have to change the way that we buy these missiles in order to stockpile them effectively, moving towards a model where you're basically buying multiple sets of long lead items at a time anytime you buy a single missile system, so that you can move faster in terms of your overall production and stockpile. It's something I'm pressing the Defense Department to do. But notably, Hugh, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Kath Hicks, when questioned about the fact that we're running low on Stingers and Javelin, said, well, we aren't really relying on these in a future fight. We don't conceptualize our war plans in this way. I totally disagree. We are learning in Ukraine that in order to deter authoritarian aggression, and specifically to deter a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, we are going to need systems like that, if not similar systems like harpoons that the Taiwans desperately need. And my sources tell me that the harpoons that we're supposed to deliver to Taiwan aren't going to arrive until 2027 at the earliest. Hugh, that's going to be too late. We are already in the window of maximum danger, and that danger is going to accelerate come January of 2024 when there's another Taiwan election, and she concludes that he cannot do this peacefully. I am very worried that, notwithstanding some of the happy talk about how China's scared after watching Vladimir Putin fail in Ukraine, they could make an aggressive move here within the next few years.
You know, drawing the wrong lessons from a war is always a danger. The 1991 quick march in Kuwait gave us an overwhelming sense of superiority that maybe led us to hubris, maybe led us into Iraq. What wrong lessons might we draw from this, Mike Gallagher?
The foremost wrong lesson that we could draw is that in order to deter a thug or a totalitarian dictator, whether he is in Moscow or Beijing, we can rely solely on soft power. Soft power is not sufficient to deter. That is the theory that the Biden administration tested in Ukraine. They relied solely on the threat of sanctions as well as relentless diplomacy, as Secretary Blinken put it, in order to deter Vladimir Putin, and it didn't work. And I think if you dig a layer deeper, there's a weird form of mirror imaging that animates that. This idea that people like Putin and Xi play by the same rules we do, or care about getting invited to COP26 or getting disinvited from the G20. They don't care about that stuff, okay? They speak the language of hard power. And the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs admitted to me under questioning that the only thing that possibly could have deterred Putin was more hard power in his path. That's the lesson we need to learn to and apply to Taiwan. We need to arm our allies with hard power yesterday.
I'm afraid that we're going to draw the lesson as well that authoritarian corrupt regimes produce badly mechanized and insufficiently supplied logistically impaired armies. I think that's true about Russia. I don't think that's true about the People's Republic of China. Do you agree with me, or do you think we ought to infer that the faults we have seen in the Russian military probably plague the People's Liberation Army?
I totally agree with you. We just think that Xi Jinping is sitting back watching his partner, the CIA director called him a silent partner. I would say the partnership is not silent. They signed a 5,000-word pledge of friendship without limits. So they are in league with each other right now. They're both dedicated to undermining the West. He's watching all these mistakes happen. And I guarantee you he's going to his PLA generals and saying, we will not make the same mistakes when it comes to Taiwan. And oh, by the way, if you're going to pursue a fait accompli strategy, you not only have to move quick, but you really have to aggressively undermine the government and the leadership of the country you are attacking. Putin underestimated Zelensky. Xi, I don't think, will make the same mistake and will take enormous steps, either through preemptive cyber attacks, disinformation campaigns, shutting down infrastructure in Taiwan to completely destabilize the government in Taiwan, especially if the DPP wins in January 2024, as they are projected to do so, and elects what is perhaps the most independence-friendly, although he hasn't said he's going to support independence, candidate in modern history. So absolutely, Hugh, we cannot base our planning on the naive assumption that the PLA will exhibit the same incompetence that the Russian military has.
Now, let's go back. Last question, Congressman Gallagher. It looks like a static front is developing something like World War One with much bigger bombs and much better artillery. Is that your assessment? Can they get to Odessa?
My honest assessment is I don't know. I think because Putin has no regard for human life, right, and is committed to a war of attrition, I think he will make slow incremental gains. And if I had to guess, I would say yes, notwithstanding the bravery of the Ukrainian forces. Although we're about to give them a massive infusion of assistance, they've proven quite nimble, resilient, capable, and I think they can at least impose enormous costs on the Russians as they try and march towards Odessa. We could see this evolving into something of a frozen conflict. I mean, ask yourself, Hugh, did the Syrian war ever really end? A war that Russia was intensely involved in? No. Slaughter continues to this day. It's completely torn apart the country. We could see something similar happen to Ukraine, and that would be a tragedy. I will say I'll give one attaboy to the administration, and I rarely do that. I've been very critical of their foreign policy. I think that the Secretary of Defense going to Kyiv was the right move. I think him finally talking about in terms that the Ukrainians can win and we want Russia to be permanently weakened was the right move. That's the right signal to send to our partners on the ground to give them increased confidence that they can continue to impose enormous costs on the Russians, even as Putin concentrates on consolidating its gains in the south.
Bonus question, you're a Marine. We sent 90 howitzers, and everyone said, wow, 90 howitzers. And I thought to myself, 90 howitzers? I mean, what do 90 howitzers do? What do 90 howitzers do?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to be on the other side of a howitzer. They could be pretty deadly when employed effectively. I think the more impactful assistance has been, you have high end, you have low end, right? On the high end, we've seen the Ukrainians use UAVs to devastating effect to take out Russian warships. On the low end, you have things like sniper rifles, which employed in the right way can absolutely disrupt the command and control of a very sophisticated military. And look at all the Russian generals that are getting killed on the battlefield. So it's really a mix of high-end and low-end assets.
Congressman, where do aircraft fit in? I know the UAVs and the Turks are selling them, but they need fighter planes, don't they?
That has been my contention from the start. I think we missed a massive opportunity at the beginning of this conflict to provide them with more fighter planes. There was some concern about their ability to sustain them logistically. I think those concerns were overblown. But that would really, I think, even up one of the advantages that Russia has in this conflict.
Congressman Mike Gallagher from the state of Florida. Now, not really, but since I thought maybe you were traded to Florida for Rick Scott in the president's mind. But God, never. That's because they've got better football in Wisconsin. Thank you, Congressman Mike Gallagher. Follow him on Twitter at Rep Gallagher. We'll talk to him again next week on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by United States Senator Dan Sullivan of the great state of Alaska, representing most of the United States, because that is a huge state. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Great to be back on the show.
I am used to when Democrats win, they bring along all their environmental activists. But usually they have the good manners not to put their environmental activists in charge of what they had lobbied for. You called them out on this. Would you explain to the people what they did by bringing in folks from the environmental activist cadre?
Absolutely. It's a huge issue. In December of this past year, I wrote the Inspector General at the Department of Interior. And I said, hey, you need to look into four senior officials at the Department of Interior, all of whom were working with environmental groups or other groups that had interest in shutting down Alaska, and a long, long list of activities that these individuals did. And now they are actually in charge for the American people, because they're senior officials at Interior, on policies that are doing the exact things that they did when they were working for these radical environmental groups, and it's a huge conflict of interest. And I lay out the statute and the executive order saying you can't lobby and work on something and then go do it with regard to positions of trust now held for the American people. And they're doing it in my state. 22 executive orders or executive actions, Hugh, focused on shutting down Alaska, singularly focusing and targeting Alaska, Alaska's working families. It is just remarkable. When the national Dems get into power, they institute what I always refer to as the anti-Alaska agenda. They essentially say to all the radical environmental groups, hey, you want to shut down the great state of Alaska? Don't let us help Alaska produce oil, minerals, natural gas. Go ahead.
It is amazing.
It's unbelievable. My state's under assault.
If anyone came from an oil company and ran Alaska, there would be shouts and cries of horror that conflict of interest was involved. But if you come from the white hats, the alleged white hats in the blue bubble, they're allowed to shut down your state. I'm glad you got to get the inspector general up before the Senate.
Oh, trust me. I'm working this daily. I just recently asked for, they're supposed to do recusal letters, right? If they're supposed to be working on something. You know this. You're a good lawyer, worked in the government. I've asked for all the recusal letters. I've asked for emails. I am going after them hard, and here's why. Because they're going after my state, and I'll tell you this. It gets me really.
You can't say that, Senator.
Really, am I allowed to say that on
No, no. Radio? You're going to have to defend me against the FCC.
It gets me riled up. I don't want to get you in trouble. Sorry, Hugh. But it gets me riled up. And by the way, this isn't an issue that people just in Alaska should care about. Our state, whether it's our strategic location, our incredible lethal military up there, you know, we have over 100 fifth-generation fighters now stationed in Alaska, more fifth-gen fighters in my state than any place in the world, critical minerals, oil and gas. This matters to America and our, you know, competition, which I think is going to be with us for decades against the dictators in Russia, dictators in China. And we have a federal government who comes in and is shutting down the great state of Alaska. 2 weeks ago, Biden took more than half of what's called the National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska, NPRA, probably the most prolific oil territory in the world right now. In an executive order, took it half of it off the table. This was set aside by Congress decades ago for oil and gas drilling. Americans should be pissed off about this, not just
you can say that. And okay. I'll tell you what, anyone who is upset with oil and gas prices, just take a look at what they've done, which is sequester half of Alaska. Now, Senator, I also want to turn to Ukraine because you're on the Armed Services Committee. I've got Cotton coming up. I had Gallagher last hour. You're one of the few people in the United States legislature, the federal government, that has combat experience. What is going on? Do you think we are now in a static World War One with modern weapons situation in Ukraine?
Well, look, the biggest thing that happened in Ukraine, in my view, Hugh, and you may have seen yesterday, we had the intel, the head of the director of national intelligence and the head of the DIA in front of the Armed Services Committee. And what happened was they did a very good job, in my view, our intel community, prior to the invasion in terms of the prediction of what was going to happen. And a lot of people didn't believe it. A three-pronged attack. They're going to try and take out Zelensky, install a puppet government. They predicted all of that. So our intel community did a really good job. But after the invasion, what they were telling all of us and the intel they were telling executive branch folks and also the Senate was that the Ukrainians were going to get crushed within 7 days. So that was the going in assumption that everybody was making decisions under. And as you know, that dramatically limited the options that we were contemplating, because people are like, well, look, if they're going to get crushed in 7 days, we're not going to send them weapons. We're not going to send them high-tech weaponry. And so it took the Pentagon in particular weeks to move away from this assumption that they're going to get crushed to, hey, they can win.
Right.
And what I've been doing is pressing the Pentagon almost daily to more weapons, lethal weapons, tighter sanctions, intel sharing. That is actually really, really important. Full intel sharing. And here's the other one. It goes back to our early conversation. unleash American energy. It's one of our great strategic advantages. Every ally I speak to in Europe, especially the Baltics, Poland, Germany, what do they say? We need American energy so we can get off the Russian energy. So to me, that is what we need to keep doing. The Pentagon's finally coming around to it, but they got a slow start because the assumption going in was that the Ukrainians were going to last 7 days and then the Russians were going to take over the whole country.
Well, now the assumption is, again, I'm referencing Avril Haines' testimony yesterday that she is not confident that the fight in Donbas will effectively end the war. What do you think that means? Are we really going to be into the 4 years of trenches and long-range artillery shelling?
Well, look, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I don't think anyone knows what the answer is. But I think what we need to continue to do is press every lever that we have. Of course, weapon systems and sanctions. I think these sanctions are going to be devastating. But then unleash the other instruments of power that we have. And to me, the one that I've been pressing this administration on, in addition to military assets, is our energy assets. And as I've been, you know, the frustration here, and it should be for all Americans, is that the Biden administration essentially hates American energy, right? From day one, these guys have come in and tried to shut down American energy, American pipelines. They've strong-armed financial institutions to not invest in American energy. John Kerry, literally, I know this from Japanese officials I've talked to, has been in Asia saying, be careful on buying American LNG. I mean, are you kidding? What team is this guy on? Whose side is he on?
Well, we get the inflation number in about 30 minutes, and it's going to be above 8% unless they've fiddled with the numbers. This is not sustainable for Americans, Senator.
Absolutely not. And, you know, the thing, I don't know if you saw some of Biden's press conference yesterday.
Oh, yeah, I played it all.
Just absolutely pathetic.
And you got to go over and start calling Rick Scott, the senator from Wisconsin, because that's what the president said. So,
you know, I mean, look, what's so funny, I put out a tweet yesterday going through the list of the Biden administration's explanations with regard to inflation. If you remember, first, it's not happening. Then it was transitory. Then you might remember, oh, this is a high class problem. Then it was, well, actually, this is a good thing. Then it was COVID's fault. Then it's Putin's fault. And now it's the ultra MAGA Republicans' fault. I mean, this is literally in the last year. And look, the American people are wise, Hugh. They know exactly whose fault it is. It's Joe Biden's fault. It's the Federal Reserve's fault. It's Biden's anti-energy policy's fault. And, you know, this is the number one issue. As you say, it's not only unsustainable, it is crushing middle-class and working-class Americans.
Well, you know, it used to be, Senator, and let's close here, it used to be the answer to high prices is high prices, meaning that if high prices existed, producers would rush in. They're not allowed to rush in. This goes back to your point about Alaska. They can't rush in to save America right now because Biden won't let them produce oil and gas.
That's 100% true. The signals that the feds are sending. Think about all the radical federal nominees. Now, we've been able to kill a couple here in the Senate, but that they've put forward these financial issues dealing with finance, whether it's the Fed, whether it's the comptroller of the currency, whether it's senior Treasury officials, and they all come in with this radical anti-energy mindset where they want to choke off capital to the American energy sector.
They want to kill Alaska. You persuaded me, and good luck in getting those witnesses up there, Senator Dan Sullivan. And we forgive you your mistake. You can take the man out of Ohio, but you can't take Ohio out of the man. So a little Ohio talk there. We got rid of it. We bleeped it out. Senator Dan Sullivan, always a pleasure, Senator. Don't go anywhere, America. It's Hugh Hewitt.
Senator Rick Scott, Wisconsin. Remember this.
Welcome back, America. I'm just checking with Senator Tom Cotton which state he's from, because apparently the bingo card has been tossed up. Senator Cotton, are you still from Arkansas?
Last I checked, you, but I want to see what Joe Biden thinks. Maybe Joe Biden is worried that Rick Scott's going to move to Wisconsin and beat Tammy Baldwin in 2024, but I've got Mike Gallagher on that bingo card.
I know I got Gallagher on there too, and I talked to him about it, and he said that's what you. It's the reverse of what usually happens. Wisconsin people flee to Florida in the summer. Now Rick Scott's been traded to Wisconsin. Look, let's get serious. Yesterday, the director of national intelligence, Avril Haines, told senators that she is not confident that the fight in Donbass will effectively end the war. I'm not confident of anything. What do you think is going on in Ukraine? How do you assess the latest development, Senator Tom Cotton? You're on Armed Services.
Well, at the same hearing, we had Lieutenant General Barrier, who's the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and I probed on this question as well. He said, I think correctly, that the fight in the Donbass right now is a stalemate. That does not mean peace. It does not even mean armistice or ceasefire. It means very intense fighting with no decisive outcome. However, he further pointed out that as both sides try to build more combat power, in particular by recruiting and deploying more troops, that Ukraine should have the advantage because the Ukrainian army has fought bravely and very ferociously, as one tends to do when fighting for one's home against an aggressive invader. By contrast, the Russian army, full of conscripts and soldiers who were lied to until they were going to a training exercise, have fought very poorly. The morale is very low. That's one reason, Hugh, why all those Russian generals are getting killed. They have to go to the front lines to ensure their orders are being executed. In our army, generals don't go to the front line because they count on colonels and captains and sergeants to execute their orders for them. So as long as we continue to support Ukraine to ensure they have the arms that they need to defend their territory, I don't think you'll see further Russian advances. And in some point, I think you could see a catastrophic collapse of Russian morale that would allow the Ukrainians to break out and seize the rest of their territory back.
We can pray for that. Senator Cotton, before I come back to the war, I got to ask you, Dave McCormick, who I have endorsed in Pennsylvania, is a veteran of the 101st Airborne, Bronze Star recipient, Ranger Tab. Is there going to be a secret handshake between you two if he wins through to the Senate? Are there any other 101st Airborne people up there?
Hugh, if I'm not mistaken, I think Dave was a veteran of the 82nd Airborne. So you might.
Oh, I better not get that wrong.
That you put him in the 101st Airborne. But a very distinguished military service career, and he's a fine man, and I wish him all the best in his campaign on Tuesday.
All right, now let's go back to drawing the wrong lessons from the war. I was talking to Gallagher about this. I'm a civilian. I am not a general. I'm not a strategist. I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn. But I think in 1991, the speed with which the United States won, and in 2003 in Afghanistan, and 2001 in Afghanistan, 2003 in Iraq, may have led us to conclude we were invincible. I also think there's a danger now in thinking that totalitarian regimes are all going to be corrupt and their armies aren't going to work. Would you apply any lesson of the Russian army to the Chinese army?
Well, I think Xi Jinping certainly has to harbor concerns that his general staff may be misrepresenting to him the quality of his army in the same way that it appears the Russian general staff misrepresented it to Vladimir Putin. Or for that matter, that he just harbors doubts about the quality of his own soldiers, and that his general staff may not understand that, perhaps the way the Russian general staff did not. I mean, remember, our army has been fighting for 20 years. We have many seasoned veterans, many soldiers with whom I served are just now starting to take over battalion command. That means our battalion commanders are colonels who have 4, 5, 6 deployments underneath their belts. The Russian army, and especially the Chinese army, has nothing like that. So perhaps they are as good in the field as they might appear to be on paper. Xi Jinping, I think, has to have doubts that that's the case.
Now, Senator Cotton, Congressman Gallagher last hour said he's concerned about the United States going, quote, full Winchester. I stopped him and said, for the benefit of the Steelers fans and me, what does that mean? He said, depleting all of our supplies, just shooting everything out. Do you have that concern about America's arsenal having made a lot of donations to Ukraine in a good cause?
I do, Hugh. We have large stockpiles of munitions like Javelins and to a lesser extent Stingers. We're moving beyond Stingers into next-generation surface-to-air missiles. The problem is the pace at which our industrial base can produce them. We had a hearing yesterday about the Army's 2023 budget, and we raised this with them because I'm very concerned that we are not producing enough of these missiles to supply not just ourselves, but allies and partners like Ukraine and Taiwan. The lead times on something as relatively simple as the Javelin, I think, would shock many of your listeners, Hugh. I mean, we've been told anywhere from 18 to 30 months.
What?
This is not an aircraft carrier. It's not even a tank. It's a relatively simple weapon. I mean, it's complex in design and very elegant in the way it defeats modern tanks with reactive armor. But again, it's the size of a golf bag that a soldier can carry on his person and shoot from his shoulder, and that you could learn how to employ in the span of probably an afternoon. The fact that we have allowed our industrial base to wither to the point for it to take 18 to 30 months to replace our stockpiles is unacceptable. And I think it requires a major infusion of money to the Department of Defense that will then be able to run these lines at full capacity and beyond to make sure that we don't face a shortage.
I honestly thought you were going to say 6 months, Senator. I thought you were going to say 6 months to produce a Stinger or a Javelin. 18 months. Wow. You know, an enemy can get a long way in 18 months.
The numbers I've heard in classified settings, again, I think would astonish your listeners. Even when Pentagon witnesses have said they're ramping up production, it's still short by a factor of 2, 3, or 4X.
Last question for you, Senator. Last time you were on the show, you said we needed to get the judgment issued by the court in Dobbs opinions to follow. Since then, we've had a bill moved through providing for security for the justices, which underscores your point that this is a very dangerous situation for fanatics in the country. Is that bill going to pass? And do you still think the court should issue its judgment opinions to follow?
Hugh, it's passed the Senate. I think it'll pass the House this week. It closes a loophole that allows the Supreme Court police to provide security, not just for the justices, but for their family members as well, much as we do for the president and the vice president. Hugh, here's what needs to happen, though. Joe Biden to come out and condemn these protests at private homes, and he needs to enforce federal law. There's a federal law directly on point that prohibits protesting outside the home of a judge or a juror or a prosecutor with the intent to influence them in any pending matter. That is exactly what these protesters are doing. And the fact that they won't even condemn them, much less even-handedly enforce federal law, is outrageous. It shows that they are politicizing federal law enforcement. Those protests need to stop. Night. Federal law enforcement officers should be present at the homes of these justices, and they should arrest anyone who goes to those homes. And if they don't do that, then Merrick Garland may need to face impeachment proceedings.
Senator Tom Cotton, I agree with you 100%. It has never happened before, a leak, nor has this ever happened before against individual justices. Thank you, Senator. I know you're rushing this morning, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. He's on Judiciary, he's on Armed Services, he's on Intel. I look forward to Gallagher every week. I look forward to Cotton every week because they're both on Armed Services and they're both on Intel. Now, of course, they never give us anything that they shouldn't give us, but they do give us a lot. And you can glean a lot by talking with them.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.